From the campus of Stanford University, this is Schools In.
They believe that what we're being told is everything they need to know, and they just pay attention to that.
You actually have to teach the teachers how to teach for innovation.
With your hosts, Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
Welcome to Schools In. I'm Denise Pope, senior lecturer with the Graduate School of Education here at Stanford, and I am with my co-host, Dan Schwartz, who is the dean of the Graduate School of Education.
Hello, Denise. Free speech Pope.
I'm a free speech proponent now?
Well, not that kind of free speech.
Okay.
This is free in the sense that you'll give away your speeches for free.
Well, no. Now, wait, Dan. I do charge people when I go and give speech. It depends on what kind of speech.
So, Denise, cost speech Pope.
I do charge people.
I think. So people have to pay to buy your books?
They do have to pay to buy my books. Books away for free if asked, you know, with a good reason, if they can't afford it, let's say.
I like stand on the corner of the street with my journal articles. Hey, buddy, take one, please.
No one's reading your stack, Dan? Is that what you're saying?
My mom, the first paper I ever published. I sent it to my mom. I was very proud. It was a top journal in my field. And I gave it to her. You know, that was like the only other person who read it besides the guy who wanted to prove me wrong.
Right.
And her comment was, oh, that's why I've always disliked psychology.
Oh, no.
I know.
But she loves you. And yes, this is it. Moms are there to, yeah. You know, if you can't send it to your mom.
So I you know what? I violated copyright. I actually just sent her a copy.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's a big no.
It is a big no.
So copyright is an interesting thing,
yeah.
Right? And I had a similar experience. I wanted my mom to see an article I was really proud of in a journal. I'm not going to say the name, but it's a newspaper that charges people to subscribe.
Okay.
And I could have easily just sent her the article, you know, that I wrote it, and I could have just sent her the original copy. But the newspaper made it look cool and had really cool pictures and graphics, and I wanted her to see it in print. And there's something about seeing, you know, your daughter's name in print. And I went to send it to her, and there was a paywall. Do you know what a paywall is?
I assume it's something you climb.
No. Well,
It's a mountain of dollars, and you climb.
Kind of, yes. Basically, in order for her, or actually even me, to click on that article, you have to subscribe to that newspaper and pay like a monthly fee.
So you did.
So
you did for your mom.
I actually did.
Right. So there you go. So I too am willing to pay people to read my stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. But I didn't break copyright. I mean, I guess you could, you know, some people, I'm not saying that we should do this, but some people take pictures. So one person gets it, right? And then you take pictures download it.
That must be wrong.
That's against the law.
Oh, okay.
But I will tell you too, and I don't know if our guest is going to talk about this, but when you're a professor—
About whether his mom read his work.
if he shows his papers to his mom.
Yeah.
When you're a professor and you put a reader together, a lot of people do this illegally. And I am one of the few—
So a reader is, you've chosen a bunch of articles you want the students to read, and you put them together.
And you put them together, and they purchase a reader full of articles, and you're supposed to pay royalties to the authors and copyright fees.
Mm-hmm.
And I do it legally, and it actually costs a lot of money to the students, and the students get upset, and they say other people do it illegally, and it's cheaper.
So how much?
A lot more. Sometimes it's like $20 more, $30 more. But our guest is going to talk about this, I think.
Okay. All right. So So from the author's perspective, I sort of do want people to pay.
So you get your royalty check.
No, so that the company that's putting together my articles will do it well.
Hmm.
And they'll be responsible for advertising. Like if I do a book, like I've written two books.
Yes, Dan, I've written two books too. It's not a competition. Our guest has written many more than us.
It's always a competition. No. But one of them was a free PDF. And the other one, you know, was with a publisher who charges. And the publisher who charges advertises and stuff like that. Whereas the one that's the free PDF, it just sits there. Nobody downloads it. They don't know about it.
So this is a ripe conversation that we're about to have.
It is. It is. And so we are very fortunate to have someone who can bring sanity to this conversation. It's John Walensky, who is the Kosla Family Professor of Education at Stanford. So John has had an illustrious career. He was a curriculum specialist, but deep down inside, he's a philosopher and a historian of education. He recently had a book came out that sort of traced kind of the ownership of ideas from John Locke forward, or maybe even earlier than John Locke. So John, welcome. Thanks, you for coming. Dan. So what, just to get everybody up to speed who isn't a nerd, what is public access?
So public access, and really we call it, often call it open access, is focused on research and scholarship. It's a move that's born of the digital era. It's kind of a post-Napster response to the idea that we should be able to distribute research and scholarship on an open and free basis, but not without paying the publishers. So if I might follow up on that part, the
Yes, please do.
The notion is that, go back to your point, Dan, that we want quality. It isn't free or cheap to publish work, but we don't need to lock it up. So the simple solution or the simple approach is to say that we're spending about $10 billion a year on subscriptions to university journals.
$10
billion? $10 billion. Who's paying that money?
The libraries are writing checks. There are a few individuals subscribe, but not very many anymore.
Is this the world, the U.S.?
This is the world. Sorry, this isn't Paulo. This isn't Stanford University.
Okay.
This is the world. But Stanford is paying millions.
Yeah.
And the concern now is that that work should be freely available at the same cost. That why don't we write the same checks and make all of this work available to both of your mothers and many more beyond that?
So, wait, the universities would continue to pay billions of dollars, but then that payment would free it up so that everybody else could have access to it.
That's right. And we call that open access to research and scholarship.
Why would universities want to do this for the rest of the world?
Because universities see themselves as contributing knowledge to the rest of the world, because universities are concerned about issues of social justice and equity in terms of access to knowledge. And as educators, the three of us are very committed to making sure that people have opportunities to learn to the full extent of their ability. And access to knowledge is one of those principles.
So I would have thought the argument would have been different.
Okay.
I thought the argument would be, for the most part, the federal government, our taxes pay for this research, and therefore it should be a public good.
Yes, by all means. And institutions like Stanford are tax exempt on top of that.
Right.
So there is the argument that taxpayers have a right to this information, and there is an argument that it's a universal human right. Having access to knowledge. So there are lots of arguments in its favor, and in fact, the publishers are in support of open access. The key issue at this point, now that we have everybody on board, is how do we get there? Mm-hmm. By what means?
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope, and we are talking with John Walensky about open access to research and publications. So when you say everybody's on board...
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe if I get a grant from NIH, the National Institute for Health, any publication that comes out of that has to be open access.
Within 12 months.
And so what I do is in my grant proposal, I put in several thousand dollars that I will give to the publisher to cover their costs of publishing the work, and then it can be open access. So it's a requirement of this federal granting agency.
NIH, yes.
But it's just to be clear, it's not your money, Dan. It's the NIH money that they're giving to you.
Nobody reads my articles. I'm not going to give anybody money to go read my articles, to publish
my
articles.
The audience knows.
NIH
is giving you a grant, and some of that money you are saying
I will give to the publisher to cover their costs so that when they publish my work, they will make it open access.
So they're still paying their employees.
It's not like we're against
publishers or their employees.
But Denise, there are concerns about the costs.
Ah.
So the price of that article may be for the author $3,000 on some journals and as high as $5,000 for journals like Cell. So there is some dispute about how much this costs. How much does it cost to publish an article? It's maybe 10 pages.
Right.
There are a few color pictures. pictures. It's online. There's no printing.
Right.
So there is a dispute about the cost, but let's stay with the principle of open access. The NIH is a very strong sponsor. Maybe 100,000 articles a year are made available within 12 months, not exactly immediately available. Mm. And we've had a look at the interests of doctors and research, and we found that that 12-month waiting period can be quite frustrating, that physicians, when they're given access to this knowledge, want the most recent and current work. So there's still questions about that 12-month delay.
So nobody is pushing back on open access. It's mom, apple pie. I mean—
But they're pushing back on when and how much. So about 30% of the literature now is open. And that 70% that isn't open is locked behind what you referred to, Denise, as a paywall. And so that causes a bit of an issue. How do we get from partially open, from a third of the literature open, to 100% open? NIH is a very good sponsor, but there are many, many research and scholarly articles outside of the National Institutes of Health purview. And in the social sciences and humanities, the kinds of grants that NIH gives makes a the kind of grants you get outside of NIH makes a $3,000 article cost prohibitive.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes that's like the grant, you know, for us small potato people. The people giving us money to do smaller-based research don't have that ability. And what about, like, you know, the Wall Street Journals and the New York Times and all that? Are you also saying that that should be free?
No. Actually, I'm very supportive of other forms outside of scholarly publishing. So the New York Times and Margaret Atwood and Neil Young and all of those who live by copyright should have that right. I'm talking about the universities where our salaries are already covered, where Dan, gratefully, is not dependent upon people purchasing his book.
Yeah, that's a good thing, Dan.
Yes.
You'd be homeless.
Top ramen again for breakfast.
Yes. So we're already covered, and our work is, in a sense, the part of the public good.
Right.
So I think there's a fair line to be drawn. Copyright law doesn't really look— it doesn't make that kind of distinction, and one of my projects is to look into how we could change copyright law so it recognized that there's a difference between the music of Neil Young, if I can use that example, or Joni Mitchell, to play my Canadian card here. if there's a difference between the creative artist and the scholar or researcher, and I think there is, and I think the law needs to recognize that.
So what about books, though, right? Then are you saying the books that Dan and I have written, and John, I know you've written far, far more than two. So how many have you written?
Ten.
Yes. Ten, Dan.
Wow. Okay, how much have you made?
Well into three figures, Dan.
We did not ask these things on the radio.
Sorry, we're talking about publishing and money.
Okay, fair. So, John, do you think that the books are under the purview of scholarly research and should be available open access?
I think there's still the distinction to be made. There are scholars like Stephen Greenblatt who have bestsellers and who have a right to make their money in the commercial market. And there are scholarly presses that sell only hundreds of copies. And the libraries could subscribe to those books in a way that would make them open by paying the same funds that they pay now to keep them closed.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are talking with John Walensky about the idea of libraries making paying to have open access to the articles so that everybody can have access, just the students with the ID. Basically.
So this is a subtle— the distinctions are starting to get subtle for me.
Okay, sorry.
No.
This, no, it's good. It's important to tease it out.
We're a scholarly group.
It's all
this
about
is what
nuance.
We do. This is what we do. Finer and finer distinction. So I published one book, which was really— Denise, did you know that I published? No.
Two books. So, we got it, Dan. Two books. We're going to look them up.
One of them was really sort of an academic theory book. You know, it was a one-horse pony. I could have said it in 10 pages, but I took 150. This sounds to me like the product of research. Another book is a synthesis of everybody else's research and a labor of love.
An A to Z?
It covers everybody's research from A to Z, yes. And should the university buy that? And then that, because my salary's paid.
Well,
of course, if I weren't going to get money from the book, I probably wouldn't have written it.
So then it wasn't really a labor of love.
I can love it and still want to make money from it.
Fair.
Yes,
fair.
And you can love making the money. And you should have that choice. So there's no reason why you can't say that I'm going to put this book in the market. And I'm going to take a chance on it not being purchased by libraries. I'm going to take a chance on it not doing very well. But I want to take that step and chance. So that by all means, I think the journal is an easier distinction to make than the books.
Yes, okay. I do.
But there
too.
Are many books that I think you've made the perfect distinction, Dan. I think your work, all of your books, if we divide them into two piles, both of them.
Two steaming piles.
See that the choice is there.
So you alluded to first principle, historical, a long tradition. This just seems to me like capitalism and democracy collide. There's some deeper. Take us back.
A constitutional principle. I'm a guest in this country as a Canadian, but I'm very happy to work under a constitution that says that there is intellectual property laws because Congress has the power to promote the progress of science and useful arts, to quote from the Constitution. And this idea that it is a public good to promote the progress of science is the principle I'm operating under. Mm-hmm. We're all agreed that promoting the progress of science is best achieved by open access, by having the work circulate immediately, globally, so that everyone can have access to it. And we just need to bring the law up to speed. We brought it up to speed in other ways for music streaming, for video games, for video recording. We just haven't brought up to speed the copyright law as it pertains to research and scholarship.
Wait, what is up to – okay, I might be out of it, but what is up to speed about the music streaming and the videos? Is there a new thing?
There's law. The law has been changed. So the Modern Music Act of 2018 makes it – fair for Taylor Swift to have her music streamed on Spotify. It ensures that there is compulsory licensing. It ensures that judges make a decision about how much she's paid for each time her song is listened to. And it makes a distinction about digital playing of music as different than phonographs, as they call them, of records and CDs. And so those kinds of distinctions, and of course it's a much bigger industry than $10 billion globally, music is, and music suffered greatly from the Napsterization. So scholarship needs to catch up. And the public good, I think, especially around education, the concept that high school students will have access to the latest research and knowledge, to me, is a valuable thing that we as educators should be standing up for or sitting and talking on the radio about.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We will have more with John Walensky and the concept of open access so that all of us can read research when it comes out. Next on SiriusXM Insight 121.
Students focus on what they were told, not paying attention to the situation.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
So they're not going to see anything new because they're so busy trying to copy what you told them.
From the campus of Stanford University.
Welcome back to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are talking today with John Walensky about open access. Can everyone be allowed to read what the researchers write?
Again, I wish somebody would read what I write, but I'll let it go. I'll let that my mom go. So I need some concrete models for how this might work. So I have this image of now when I go to get Denise's most recent article, a bunch of ads will show up. You know, it's like take a cruise to somewhere or do you need new shoes, and it'll pop up. So that's not very appealing. I know that early on you were a pioneer where you would ask us to send our articles to you once they'd been accepted, but before they'd been typeset.
Yes.
And then you would post them and we would ask the publishers for permission to do that, and they would always say yes.
Oh, so, not always. I had one say no.
Boy.
I know. I actually wrote to John about that. It was a couple years ago.
That's where the billions of dollars are going. That greedy. So what are some models where this works? So the NIH was one model where I, the author, cover the costs.
And a good number of universities, about 800 around the world, have a policy like we do in the Graduate School of Education that says we'll put up a copy before it's published in its final draft form, which is when we still own it, after the publisher has accepted it. Or just before the publishers accepted it, we still own it and we put it up. And so we're doing that. But that's kind of inadequate, but not only because it's been typeset, hasn't been typeset, but it may not have been copy edited fully. And there may be one or two spelling mistakes. Certainly in my work, there would be. Mm-hmm. So the latest version is this notion of subscribe to open. And let me give you an example, a concrete instance. Berghahn Books is a small publisher specializing in the social sciences, not the NIH, big dollar figures. Their subscriptions are $400 or $500 a year. But what they're going to do in 2020 is offer the libraries, the hundreds of libraries that subscribe to Berghahn Journals, a chance to subscribe to open. And that means they'll write the same check or a little more because of inflation, and they will agree that the journal will be open to everyone. So they're taking a chance in a way that they might have free ride. They might have had a free ride if they didn't do this. But this is a chance for the libraries, and the libraries, the academic libraries, are very supportive of open access because they want to serve the public and not just the community that belongs to the library.
So the risk is Stanford knows everybody else is paying, so we'll just ride that and get it for free, and we don't pay our share. That's the
right.
risk.
So that is a risk.
That's a huge risk. I mean, it's in small little institutional libraries' best interest to kind of ride the wave, isn't it?
So Berghahn's position is if they don't get enough libraries to agree, then they'll continue the subscription. From the library's perspective, they're going to end up writing the same check, whether it's for open or closed.
That's how you get around it.
But I can see it. There's a campaign. We only need two more subscribers, and it will go open.
I hope it doesn't come down to that, Dan, but I appreciate that.
That's such a cynical look, Dan.
No. I'm looking in a legal context, the goal is to look for all the problems that could happen,
yes.
not all the
totally
goodness.
Fair.
And the unforeseen consequences like free riding. So, or maybe that is foreseen. But at any rate, this is one of the models. And
it's
so
really
far, the support from the libraries has been very good. But the real test will be over the next few months and to see if 2020 will make the journals open.
So how about school books, right? School books are
textbooks.
Really – textbooks. Yeah, textbooks is even more precise. Thank you. They're not original research. They're expensive to develop. The cost to students, it's a bad thing. You're in a school that doesn't have a lot of money. When I first started teaching, I was using a 1957 grammar book.
And it was 1958 when you started
teaching? Yes, when I was 1 year old.
But I think the history and the science books are obscene. I've been in classroom where there's three different versions.
Yeah.
And are you the lucky one that got the more recent one that actually says that Pluto isn't a planet? I mean, it's crazy.
How lucky is that?
Is that lucky? I don't know. Just means it's more recent. You're more up to date.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's a huge problem.
So is there any hope on that front?
Yes. So it's a parallel movement. There's open access to research and scholarship, and there's a group called Open Educational Resources. And New Rokosala has a CK-12 project that makes textbooks freely available. The key there is we have authors that are willing to write and not for royalties. Forgive me.
Right. You say that as though I've ever gotten a royalty check. But this is just sort of a Wikipedia model. And I choose which articles that I want to put together
in
a textbook.
So actually, this CK-12 does have a Wikipedia integration. Now that we have digital means of circulating and avoiding the printing costs and delivery and all of those aspects, they can develop the textbook and distribute it. There's a group at Rice University, Stax, OpenStax maybe, that makes a whole variety of textbooks freely available on the basis of authors willing to contribute. And these are respectable authors who would otherwise be part of commercial operations. So the Open Educational Resources, this goes back to teachers sharing their lesson plans, faculty members writing textbooks. It's a whole range of materials that people want to share on the same principle that education is a right and that it shouldn't face financial impediments.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are talking with John Walensky about open access and in particular free textbooks, open access to textbooks. And I think what's really some unforeseen benefits, if you don't mind me saying, would be we look at kids who have real back issues carrying and lugging textbooks. This is an actual thing that doctors have found out. If you look at textbooks these days, they're mammoth. They're huge. We have some kids who live in two households. So digital textbooks is going to do more than just open access. It's actually going to help the backs of many a backpacking carrying child. That's a benefit.
I bet this was a side effect. You weren't thinking of open access.
The primary focus of my work.
No, not the primary focus, but a nice benefit.
My brother is an MD and interested in physical health issues. So yes, it's still part of the family.
So let's go back to the research. What is the warrant that people will actually go crazy for all this research and start reading it? The people who want to read research tend to be at universities.
Right. So we've that is a challenge. The notion is if you open it, will they come?
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Right. So yeah. We have done some experiments and research on this, and one involved giving doctors free access to Stanford University libraries.
Right. So you're a doctor in some small town. You're not affiliated with a giant hospital.
You would have no access to research virtually, or maybe just the Journal of the American Medical Association that you belong to. So we advertise free access to research, and we had 330-odd doctors sign up to get for 1 year free access to all the research they could possibly consume. Of course, what happened was not everyone took advantage of that. In fact, only a third of the doctors used the free research.
That's not bad.
And they used it about once a week. They looked at an article.
Oh, that's a lot.
It would be if it affected you or your family.
Right. Sure, the article would be relevant. Yeah.
Right. So we thought that was encouraging. The doctors told us that they didn't only use it for clinical reasons, but they did. They used it to set standards for the hospital they were working in. They used it out of curiosity, and they used it to win bets with their friends about how much they knew about medical information.
Okay, that part doesn't excite me. I'm sorry. You like that part, but I want them to help a kid who they wouldn't have been able to help.
I know, but I like how creative people are.
When the experiment ended after a year, and doctors wrote to us about withdrawal symptoms, that they were suffering from a lack of access, and they begged us to continue.
So do you think there'll be aftermarkets? Like all these publications for educators, research in education, or research in parenting. There'll be some aftermarket that scrapes this and then tries to
serves
bundle
it up.
It.
What are the issues you have today? I've noticed your daughter is looking at X on her phone. You should be looking at this kind of research.
Yeah.
Or your son's having trouble in school, carrying too many textbooks. You should be looking at this orthopedic article that recently came out.
You think this all happened?
So yes, by all means. There needs to be organization. It can be overwhelming. There are 2.5 million articles a year coming out. It's hard to keep up, believe me.
Yeah.
So all of that, there will be a market for it. But first of all, the necessary starting point, not sufficient, but necessary starting point, is our right to access this material.
Thank you so much, John, for coming. And thank all of you for listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. If you missed any of this episode, listen anytime on demand with the SiriusXM app on iTunes and SoundCloud.
From the campus of Stanford University, this has been Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.